Donald Trump says he will continue the war against Iran until there is unconditional surrender. Now, we are 7 days in to the onslaught against Iran, but we don't actually know much or enough, certainly, about what's actually happening in Iran itself. There is an internet shutdown, of course. And we can't obviously homogenize a country which has got the 17th biggest population size on Earth, a huge country, very diverse. There's no better person to talk about what's actually happening there, the complexities, the internal divisions, and where this is heading or could be heading with all of that in mind than Alex Shams, who's Iranian American. He's an anthropologist. His magazine, Ajam, do check that out. He's doing incredible work. Well, I'll talk about that actually briefly in a minute, but he was actually in Tehran, living in Tehran until not that long ago, working on his postgraduate studies, research. But firstly, I just want to say, Alex, look, lots of people are obviously shocked and horrified, but, you know, this has a particular type of emotional labor, I know, for yourself. You've got skin in the game in a way. So many of us might be horrified, but we don't. So I just want to say, I understand that, you know, that's very important to talk about. And I just really appreciate you being able to talk at what is a very grim time.
Definitely. No, I'm happy to be here. I mean, it's a really, really scary time. The bombing has not ceased in the last 7 days. And every single day there's multiple bombs. And as you mentioned, the internet kind of comes in and out. It's been hard to keep in contact with people. And what we are hearing is very, very scary.
I just want to ask, what's your kind of overall kind of take? Sounds a bit kind of, you know, it's the wrong word. I don't know what the right word is, but, you know, after 7 days of this war, what are you thinking? What's going through your head? What's your kind of overall position and what's happening right now?
I think a lot of people, including myself, are very scared. We don't know where this is going, where it's going to end. It's not clear what the goal of this war is. And when Trump says things like we're going to make Iran surrender, we know that's not going to happen. And there's no way to do that through an aerial campaign. And so what we're seeing is people are dying. I think as of today, more than 1,300 people have died, according to the Iranian Red Crescent. Hundreds of thousands are displaced. Tens of thousands are homeless. And it's not clear what has actually been accomplished. People are terrified in Tehran, and at the same time, there's this sense, I think, in the diaspora that possibly this attack was going to lead to some kind of freedom or some kind of regime change. But what we're seeing is that that's not really the case. People are dying, and the movements for change that existed in Iran before this are not continuing, right? People are fleeing bombs. They're not able to protest.
I mean, just in terms of he the people out there who, if they skim read Iran and Wikipedia for 5 minutes, would probably have more knowledge than Donald Trump has about Iran. But he clearly expected that assassinating the supreme leader Khomeini would lead to the collapse of the regime. As someone who knows a vast amount about Iran, obviously, why was that such an incorrect assumption on his part?
I think this idea that you can just assassinate a leader and then the organization will collapse is something we've seen. It doesn't bear any relationship to reality. And we've seen this over and over in different countries, in the way that Israel has launched these wars across the Middle East in recent years. And this idea that you can carry out an assassination, and that's what it was. And I think it's also important to put that in context. This is an illegal, unprovoked war. Iran was at the negotiating table, and one of the first moves that the US and Israel did was kill the political leader of Iran, which is kind of an unprecedented situation we're in which one country is assassinating the leader of the government of another country. But it also really underestimates the resilience of the Islamic Republic and the fact that this is not a regime of one person. This is millions of people. It is a larger infrastructure. And when there is a sense of threat, of existential threat, which is essentially what Trump is saying, he's saying, we're going to get rid of you guys. Of course, those people are going to band together and fight against that existential threat. People seem to forget that the Islamic Republic was forged in the Iran-Iraq war when Saddam Hussein invaded, precisely thinking that the Iranian government was weak, that he was going to take advantage of this weak new revolutionary government. And what he ended up actually doing was consolidating, or let's say helping the Iranian government consolidate power by uniting together to fight an external enemy. And this is what we saw in June when the US and Israel attacked. And it's likely that that's what's going to continue. I think for millions of Iranians who support the government. And I will say, I think these are a minority of people in Iran, but they're consequential, and they're the ones currently who are linked to the state apparatus. And they are seeing this as a reinforcement of their belief that the United States and Israel can't be trusted, they will attack at any point, and that it was a bad idea to try to negotiate with them to begin with because they're bad faith actors.
I'll come on to it because it's such an important point that about the regime's base and how that plays out. What are you, I mean, because you said, you know, the internet, it comes, it goes. What are you hearing from inside Iran in terms of your family? And maybe just explain a bit, because I said you were in Tehran for a while. So just explain a bit, you know, you were there. So, you know, it's not just family, but, you know, lots of other people. So tell us a bit about that and tell us what you're hearing about what's happening on the ground.
Yeah, so I was born and raised in Los Angeles, but I have a lot of family inside of Iran. Since I was a kid, I would go kind of on visits, and then I started doing research there for my master's, for my PhD, and then I lived there for 3 years. And during my research, I was interviewing people from all different sides of the political equation. I was talking to activists, I was talking to government officials, I talked to journalists. Basically just trying to get a sense of why so many Iranians support the government and why so many more are opposed to it and the different ways they understand what those positions mean, especially when there's all this external pressure on the country as well. And so in the last week, I've heard so many different perspectives from Iran. I think, as you pointed out, Iran is not a monolith. There are so many different opinions. And I think people are also there's a sense of whiplash because they're terrified of the bombs, but then there are people who are against this war. There are also people who are for this war. And I think this is one of the things that's really hard for people outside to kind of understand and place themselves within. But it's important to look at the last couple of months and what has happened in Iran. In late December, early January, these big protests erupted, and the government repressed them really, really brutally. And for a lot of people in Iran who took to the streets, I think also having seen what happened in Venezuela and kind of expecting that something similar might happen, they took to the streets and then were kind of shocked by this brutality that was unleashed against them. And in which there was this process of reckoning that was unfolding over the last few months within Iranian society. There were protests at universities, the funerals were turning into protests. People were really actively denouncing the government for what it had done and demanding change. And one of the saddest things about this war is that as a result, we're never going to see kind of where that goes. That process has ended. All of those activists on the ground who were fighting for change and risking their lives are now fleeing the bombs. Tens of thousands of people who were arrested are in prison right now under the bombs. And it's I think, as a result, there's been this polarization in Iranian society as well, where in the last 2 months, there is a sense among some people that that there had to be a solution coming from the outside. And then Trump is there offering, saying, we're going to send help, we're going to help you. And it feels like the global far right, I mean, specifically Trump and Netanyahu, really kind of took advantage of the real pain and suffering of so many Iranians to then provide a solution that was not a solution. And to convince people that if they could just have another go at Iran, that this time they would bring the regime down. And so one of the most bizarre things is talking to people in Iran who are supportive of the war, having bombs fall around them, and then they're watching these diaspora channels broadcast from Los Angeles or from London, like Iran International, that are basically repeating Israeli government lies and telling them the bombs are only falling on military installments, Trump is going to save you. And so they're sitting there watching bombs fall around them, telling themselves that they're not going to get hurt. And then they're shocked when the bombs start falling on residential neighborhoods all around them. And I say that to point out that that's one part of kind of like how people in Iran are seeing this, supported by a lot of people in diaspora who have also adopted these positions. But there are a lot of Iranians, especially people connected to grassroots struggles, people who have been part of movements on the ground for change and who have been risking their lives, who oppose this because they've seen what war does to Iran. They've seen how war changes society. They've seen how when there's an existential threat to the government cracks down on anyone inside society who's calling for change. And I think for them, they know that this war is not going to create an opportunity for liberation. They've seen what Israel also has committed across the region, how it committed genocide in Gaza, it's pulverizing Lebanon. And this idea that bombs or foreign intervention could fix Iran or help Iran just isn't borne out in recent history or in Iran's longer history.
I was in Baghdad a few months ago and I met lots of Iraqis, and some of whom who supported the invasion to begin with and cheered on the invasion, and they have a very different position now, obviously. They believe their country was destroyed. That obviously was a process because they went through years of trauma. What in terms of those, because this is, we're only 7 days in, for those Iranians who did support this war, do you think there's any shift, or do you think, you know, I mean, I don't know. I mean, how could we estimate how large a contingent is? I know that's probably not a realistic ask, but do you think this is likely to have some sort of shift as people see the consequences or suffer the consequences?
I do think so. I think little by little, people are becoming more and more aware of what's happening. I think on one hand, over the last week, we've seen a lot of denial, a lot of people arguing that, you know, what the images were that are coming out of Iran that are of suffering, of bombing, are AI or their propaganda. And this is very much something we've seen out of the Israeli government playbook before. And I think it's now also having its time with relationship to Iran. But at the same time, the cost is getting harder and harder to deny. More and more people are dying. We're entering into a situation where more people know someone who has died. And at this point, because of the communications blackout, it's harder for that to reach people. I mean, this is kind of one of those, this is a weird situation where people are watching diaspora channels, but they're not able to actually hear what's happening around them. And that's part of where this denial is coming from. But the more stories that we're seeing come out inside Iran about what's happening from independent sources, not from government media, this is where people really start to understand and realize what's happening around them and the suffering that's unfolding. And I hope those people will wake up, because one of the saddest parts is seeing the Iranian diaspora's pain really exploited by these far-right actors, seeing Iranians outside the country cheer on this bombing, cheer on the killing of their own people, and not realize what they're doing, really, and not realizing they can't trust these actors like Israel and the United States. Obviously, neither of them care about Iranian freedom. And it's not going to, I mean, similar to the situation of Iraq, it'll take that lived experience, it'll take recognizing the human suffering and the human toll for people to really be able to recognize the mistake they're making in advocating for this war.
In terms of the regime's base, because obviously there is this broad-based opposition to the regime in Iranian society, but it has its base. Yeah. And it strikes me that actually this is one element which is quite different from Iraq in 2003 with Saddam Hussein, with the Taliban in Afghanistan in 2001, and Colonel Gaddafi in 2011, because I think their bases at that time were actually very small. I think they had very little active entrenched support within those different societies. And it strikes me that actually this regime has a much bigger base than any of those other examples did at the time of those wars. I mean, do you think that's an accurate summary? And tell us, who are these? Who is the base, basically? I mean, that'd be quite interesting to know who are the sorts of people who support and why. And do you think that base is being consolidated and mobilized? And that's one of the reasons you're not getting what Donald Trump is demanding, total surrender.
Yeah. I think it is really hard to divide people into strict political views, because one of the things we see, and we've definitely seen it in Iran too, is that people's political opinions have shifted in response to events, which is natural and healthy, right? But I would say that probably there's a core base of support in Iranian society for the government that's like 10 to 20% of the population. And then there's a much wider diversity of people who at certain times, because of their fear of instability, because of their fear of civil war, and because of their desire to lead stable, normal lives, they'll either kind of gravitate towards the government or they'll gravitate against the government. And those people, for example, I think right now are in a situation of whiplash, particularly because they saw this bloodshed, they saw all of this economic instability 2 months ago, and now they're dealing with a horrifying military attack. But at the same time, the people who are the base, again, I would say it's a pretty diverse group of people. But you have people who were part of the 1979 revolution, the people who have family members who fought and died in the Iran-Iraq war, which also had more than 500,000 people who were wounded. So you have a lot of people who have given their lives for the system, or family members who have given their lives for the system, people who have benefited in material ways also, because especially in the 1980s and early 90s, you did have a massive expansion of social welfare, of education, and an investment in rural areas, for example, that previously was not there in Iran. And I think there's a lot of people who have also watched the political negotiations unfold over the last 20 years. And they've seen that when, for example, Supreme Leader Khamenei trusted the United States and actually signed a deal, the nuclear deal in 2015, after years of saying, you know, kind of deferring negotiations, saying we can't trust America, and then really giving his blessing to a deal that was based on trusting America. And then to see Trump 2 or 3 years later pull out, even though Iran was like holding up its obligations, I think for a lot of the people in the base, and also again, for like a wider cross-section of Iranian society, the anti-imperialist outlook of the government is also a major reason for their support. And Donald Trump has done his utmost to prove that the government is right, that, you know, that the Israel and the United States use human rights as a tool to attack Iran when it's convenient for them, but otherwise don't really care. And I think this illegal war really shows it. Assassinating the head of the government of Iran also really shows it. And all of these things reinforce the sense of existential threat, which I think, unfortunately, the opposition outside of the country, which has built up this fantasy that they're going to be able to just get rid of the Islamic Republic, that they can wish these people away, they really have not come up with any solution for what happens to these people, or what happens to the millions of people who are connected to the government in some way, because they are a part of Iranian society. They can't just be removed from the equation, and any kind of transition to democracy that we can imagine for Iran, just like any transition from dictatorship to democracy anywhere else, requires reconciliation. It requires inviting these people to understand what the government has done, understand the crimes of the government, but also recognize that we can't execute all those people, that vengeance is not the goal, justice the goal. And I think when we see Trump using execution, I mean, in this case, an extrajudicial assassination as a tool of diplomacy, it reinforces the bloodiest, worst urges in Iranian society for vengeance. And it opposes the grassroots work that Iranian activists have done for so many years. I mean, one of the most powerful and important grassroots campaigns in the last 2 years in Iran has been No to Execution Tuesdays, where hundreds of political prisoners inside Iranian jails have gone on hunger strike every Tuesday against the death penalty. And then we see Trump claiming to be on their side, murdering people. And I think this is one of the saddest parts about what Trump has accomplished, what Netanyahu have accomplished, is that they've really tapped into this urge for vengeance and bloodshed. That many Iranians, because they feel that there hasn't been avenues for democratic reform inside of Iran, and that they've tried everything, and now they don't see a way out, that they've kind of latched onto. And this is where we see this celebration when Khamenei was killed, this cathartic release for people who for almost 40 years had to see this dictator's face everywhere. But this isn't going to bring justice. This isn't going to bring liberation for Iran. It plays exactly into the hands of the Iranian government. And unfortunately, there's no clear scenario for how we're going to move from military strikes to democracy in Iran.
I mean, it strikes me, I mean, I'm just stay in the lane a bit here, but I just, in terms of the way some who have supported this war from the diaspora, the way the Iranian regime is often framed is it almost is framed as though it was some sort of imposed by an external enemy. You know, that's how it comes across. It's like basically there's this alien body which was imposed upon the Iranian people, when obviously there was in 1979 a broad-based revolution. And that again is different from those other Libya, Iraq, and Afghanistan. I mean, the Taliban had passive acquiescence in the 90s because the Mujahideen were so chaotic and murderous, but that's not the same thing. I mean, is that, you know, and then a lot of their grandchildren of those revolutionaries have understandably turned away from it. But that's the complexity, isn't it? That this was originally things have changed drastically, but it was created by a popular revolution with, at the time, big support in Iranian society. So that's why it can't be wished away. It's something very specific.
Well, and I would also point out, and I think this is something that's often missed outside the country, is that the revolution itself was extremely pluralistic. It wasn't just supporters of Khomeini. There was leftists, there were secular nationalists. A wide range of Iranian society took part in the revolution against a Shah who still managed to stay in power longer than Khomeini. I mean, this is one of the funny things. Khomeini was in power 36 years. The Shah was in power 37 years, right? He fled, also did not face justice with the help of the United States, just like Khomeini, who was killed by Israel the United States and will not face justice as a result. Mm-hmm. And what we saw that was that the Iranian Revolution was a continuation of previous revolutions in Iranian society, the Constitutional Revolution, which also opposed this kind of absolutist monarchy that the Pahlavis insisted upon, and that demanded constitutionalism. The Islamic Republic took it to another level in terms of pushing for kind of a democratic republic, or promising one, let's say, and then subverting that almost immediately from the get-go, arresting leftists, executing them, and beginning to persecute dissidents, a process that got only worse when Iraq invaded Iran. And and so when we're talking about grandparents, or sorry, grandchildren of revolutionaries, right, we're not just talking about grandchildren of Islamist revolutionaries, we're also talking about grandchildren of leftist revolutionaries, of secular nationalist revolutionaries, of all of these other people who fought for a better Iran, continue fighting for a better Iran, and who were always opposed to those who supported the Shah's government, right? And what we've seen now is that a number of these people who supported the Shah's government at that time, or their families, have kind of reconstituted around the figure of Reza Pahlavi, the son of the deposed Shah, with this idea that we can turn back time, right? Instead of promising a better future for Iran, a more democratic future, or recognizing the work that's been done on the ground for decades in Iran, they have this kind of fantasy that we're just going to roll back the clock to when things were better, and in which they were not actually better, right? Evin prison, the place where political prisoners are held in Iran today, was established by the Pahlavi regime. And many of the worst aspects of repression of freedom of speech that we see today in Iran, we can see them similar on a different scale earlier, right? And so this idea that if we could just turn back the clock, everything would be better is dangerous, it's a fantasy, and it plays directly into this kind of right-wing vengeance and this desire to go back to a time when things were better, and to attack and remove all of these people who, in the discourse of the pro-Pahlavi right wing, are often kind of configured as coming from Arab countries, coming from out being imposed upon Iran. Iran is occupied by this foreign regime, which at the end of the day speaks to an inability to even recognize that these people are also Iranians, and that they need to have a place in Iran's future. They can't be wished away.
With, you mentioned there Reza Pahlavi, and obviously he does have very vocal support amongst particularly the diaspora, but we saw his name being chanted as well in some of the protests. Yeah. But only, so I mean, again, it's very anecdotal, and obviously the internet was shut down, so you know, we don't know how many people were engaged in that kind of chanting. But what do you think about the level of support he has within Iran?
I think It's a dangerous game, as I pointed out, even when we were trying to think about like how big is the base and how many people support the government. It's a dangerous game to try to figure that out. Not only because there's no free and open polling, but also because people's opinions change very quickly, right? 3 years ago, we saw a very wide-ranging revolt across Iran in the name of woman, life, freedom, a leftist slogan that comes from the Kurdish feminist movement. And then 2 or 3 years later, we see these protests across the country where people are yelling, long live the king. And it's important to note that that's one of the slogans that was in those protests, that then there's this entire media ecosystem of pro-Shah people outside the country who amplify those slogans specifically and try to convince everyone that that's actually the only slogan. Because, of course, we saw other slogans, one of the most well-known being death to the... I have to translate from Farsi, but basically, no to the Shah, no to the religious leader, no to any oppressor, right? And so we do see these different slogans, but at the same time, it was undeniable that this time there were a lot of people calling for the Shah to return. And I knew people who had been active in the Woman Life Freedom protests who said they didn't want to go down to the streets because they were afraid that this was actually a fascist minority of society that was hoping to push Iran into a bloodbath. And we saw an incredible amount of violence unleashed by the government against the protesters. We also saw protesters attacking security officials, pulling Basijis out of the crowd and killing them. We had reports of hundreds of people killed on that side, and many more thousands, and I don't want to create any kind of false equivalence. The government killed far more people. But what I want to point out is that there is a lot of anger against the government, rightfully so. People are very angry. People are angry that their opportunities have been taken away from them, that they lived through a war last year and then the government continued repressing them, that there wasn't this democratic opening that the government could have done in which it invited people of different political views to come together, and also to recognize that Iranians of all backgrounds and political beliefs suffered in the war. And instead, it continued business as usual with continued repression, right? Because of this fear of these existential threats. And I think in Iran, people are looking for someone, a way out, right? They try democratic reform inside the system. Mir Hossein Mousavi, who in 2009 promised a democratic opening, is still in house arrest in Iran. And so all of these options of people within the system or just within Iran who have fought for years to democratize the system, to change the system, who in the last few years have called for a referendum on the Islamic Republic, and I think with the idea that they would call for an Iranian republic, right, in the sense of a more secular democratic republic, all of these people have been repressed by the government over and over and over. And so when people see that the government is unwilling to create any avenue or to allow any avenue for Iranians to express themselves, then they gravitate to figures outside the country who promise to save them. And so I think it's unfortunate and also logical that people feel like they've tried all these different avenues, that they're open to trying this avenue too. And again, I don't want to speak in terms of majorities or minorities, but I think there are people around the world who have been attracted to these far-right visions of military power, who see Trump as this big guy who's going to beat down the people who are oppressing them. And it's logical that they turn to him. That doesn't mean we should support it. That doesn't mean we should amplify those views or that we need to say those are the voice of Iranians. I mean, I think, and I want to go back to something you said, right? Iranians have so many different opinions. They are not a monolith. They're pluralistic. And the goal is not to amplify real voices of every Iranian. It's to think about how to position ourselves against an illegal imperialist war and in solidarity with the people on the ground who have risked their lives in grassroots activism. And those people, since before this war, since last year, and since many years, have been saying sanctions don't help Iran, military intervention doesn't help Iran. All of these techniques that the United States and Israel have imposed on Iran under the claims of helping freedom have actually hurt Iranians. They've impoverished them, and they've comparatively strengthened the regime. Because the Iranian people have gotten sicker, they've gotten poorer, but the Revolutionary Guard still controls the borders. It has an extensive smuggling network, and it benefits from foreign pressure in ways that we've kind of discussed in this conversation. And I think listening to the voices of people who have been taking this kind of principled stance against domestic tyranny, against military intervention, foreign intervention, that's kind of where I see the possibility of understanding where democratic reform comes from in Iran.
You mentioned before that a fear amongst, I guess, the kind of middle ground within Iranian society is the spect of civil war. And I wondered how plausible do you think that threat actually is? And I guess throwing into the mix there the proposed, or the active, I guess, US and Israeli support for arming armed groups from within certain minorities like the Kurds, but not just the Kurdish people. That's the spectre of balkanization, I guess, which people fear. But there's obviously also the political divisions. There's lots of different, very entrenched divisions within society. Is that something you fear? Do you think that it's plausible?
It feels like right now Israel and the United States don't really have a clear goal, or let's say they have some goals, but what they're doing doesn't necessarily achieve those goals. And so what's happening on the ground is they're weakening the Iranian state, and they're trying to create avenues for armed actors to be able to take advantage, right? And so we've seen this, for example, as you mentioned, where in the last few days there's been extensive bombing of Iranian Kurdistan. All of the major cities, including the town that Mahsa Jina Amini, the woman whose death sparked the uprising a few years ago, they have been bombed extensively by Israel and the United States. And part of the idea is to create this specter that armed groups from outside the country could enter Iran and take advantage. And now those groups are not going to be able to take over the state, but what they could do is trigger civil conflict in different areas. And I think many, many Iranians are afraid of the possibility of civil war because people are very angry. There's a desire for revenge that, if not channeled into justice, into transitional justice, could lead to that kind of violence. And we saw it 2 months ago. I mean, this is when we look at what happened in those protests, when the government began unleashing repression against the crowds. As I mentioned, people in the crowds, some came with knives and they defended themselves from the government attacks. And as a result, you get thousands more people who have experience of direct violence at the hands of the government, people on the side of the security forces who also believe that the other side is going to kill them, right? And this is exactly a recipe for civil war and for civil conflict. And I don't think it's going to be one of those things where, for example, we can say, well, 70 or 80% of Iranians are unhappy about the government, so of course the opposition's going to win, because the weapons are in the hands of the security forces, and you can't defeat a bunch of heavily armed soldiers and the Revolutionary Guards with knives in the street, right? You might be able to get an emotional release through that kind of violence, but you're not going to win a war. And a civil war is a recipe for more dictatorship, for more authoritarianism, and for a disaster in Iran that, because this gets to the complexity of the Iranian situation, right? Because for the last 15 years, the Iranian government has been warning the Iranian people, saying, we're going to become Syria if you guys try to protest. We have to stop Iran from becoming Syria. And this was the famous slogan that when I lived in Iran was plastered everywhere, which is that we went to fight in Syria to prevent Iran from becoming Syria, right? But this logic, this idea that we're going to support a repressive dictator who's fighting against a revolution, and thinking that the revolution is the problem, or even the militarization of the revolution is the problem, and not recognizing that the brutal violence of Bashar al-Assad was central and core to the reason why so many Syrians were able to risk everything to defeat his regime, and then thinking that if we militarize Iranian society enough, if we intervene in these other countries, we're going to stop that from coming to Iran. Whereas in fact, what we've seen is a kind of imperial boomerang of these heavily armed forces and Basijis and Revolutionary Guards who fought in Syria are now using that violence against the Iranian people. And one of the imprisoned, I believe he might have just come out of prison, but one of these opposition leaders, Tajzadeh, who has been in and out of prison for opposing the government, demanding democratic reform, he made this comment against Khamenei. He said, for years you've been warning we're going to become Syria, but we actually have become Syria. You're the Ba'athist regime, right? Where this country that does have institutions with a limited democratic possibility, and that for years Iranians tried to expand, instead Khamenei presided over a closure, over a tightening of dictatorship, over direct and obvious election rigging that basically made people feel hopeless about the possibility of reform, and as a result created exactly the recipe for what we're seeing. He created kind of the context, and now we see Israel and Trump trying to light the match underneath it.
I mean, given that you said earlier on that a surrender, that's not going to happen. And that's been pointed out over and over again by analysts who know what they're talking about, which is that would be an existential issue for the regime. I mean, the regime would just, you know, anyone who emerged from within who tried to capitulate, that would be the end of them immediately. It wouldn't work. But then, you know, Donald Trump's going to, and Israel have made clear as things stand, they're going to just keep bombing and bombing. So it's hard to see how, where this goes. So I just wondered if you had any thoughts on that. That, you know, I mean, is it hot on days? I know this is a grim thing to talk about. One day seven, and you mentioned the death toll, and obviously we could be much higher. We don't know because of lots of different factors. But how do you see this playing out? Do you have any? I mean, it's quite macabre to ask this, I realize, but do you have any thoughts about how this could possibly play out, given what Donald Trump is demanding is not actually realistic?
It's hard to answer for the reasons you said. I mean, it's hard to predict. What I can do is kind of share some of the discussions that I've been having with other people about how kind of we see this going. My sense is that Trump thought he could score an easy victory. He could kill Khamenei, and that the people behind in the rest of the Islamic Republic, let's say the other leaders, would immediately come begging for mercy. I think Iran has shown that that's not what's going to happen, that they are willing to plunge the region into a war because they do believe this is an existential threat. They're listening to Trump, they're listening to Netanyahu, and they're saying, if you guys want to destroy us, well, we're going to show you that we cannot be destroyed. And that's what we see with all of these attacks on the countries around Iran, especially those that host U.S. bases. Iran is kind of highlighting to people, or to governments in the region, that there is a price for allying with the United States when the United States is launching a war against Iran. And there's a few different outcomes that could happen here, right? At some point, if Iran is able to keep up the pressure on the regional economy and through these tactics, it's going to cause enough of a shock that Trump is going to want to finish this and to end it. I think Trump has kind of realized there's no easy victory. He's looking at Iran, hoping that someone emerges. And what I also want to reinforce, and this is something that often people get wrong, there's this idea that Iran doesn't come to the negotiations table or that the Islamic Republic doesn't sign deals with the rest of the world. In fact, they do. We saw the nuclear deal in 2015. A year ago, they agreed to a ceasefire with Israel and the United States 12 days into the war. And I think it's very possible that is going to be what happens now. But the question is when, because I think in Iran, the government is trying to come to the negotiating table at the strongest position possible. They don't want to repeat this. They don't want the U.S. and Israel to launch another war. They want an agreement that allows them to save themselves. And I think Trump has also realized that state collapse is not in the interest of the United States. Similar to Venezuela, he wants to deal with a despotic regime. He just wants it to be a despotic regime that will talk to him and give him what he wants. But you know, one of the funniest things when I was living in Tehran was that everywhere you went, you saw Donald Trump's books for sale, right? The Art of Negotiations, The Art of the Deal. All of these books were translated into Farsi and were widely read. And I think we have to keep in mind the fact that the people in Iran's government have also been reading those books. They understand that Trump is trying to force Iran into a lower position so that it comes to surrender, and they're refusing to give him that. And at the end of the day, the bombs are going to keep falling because Trump is insisting that he won't deal with Iran like a country, like an equal, like another state, but rather he wants them to come demanding surrender, right? Crying uncle. And I don't think that's going to happen. I think the Iranian government is going to do whatever it can to avoid that. And the question is, at what point will Trump decide that enough is enough and call this off?
And just a couple of final things on that. I mean, the humanitarian arguments that have been made in favor of this war, that this is about saving the Iranian people and help, you know, that's what Donald Trump said earlier in January, help is on its way. Obviously, you're talking about the protesters. Obviously, there's a long history of the US using humanitarian rhetoric to justify military interventions. I mean, Donald Trump does that less, I would say. The kind of moral arguments of US imperialism is not something he's that fluid in. But what do you make of that? I mean, just in terms of what's happening to Iran and those claims made by certainly some of the cheerleaders of this attack.
I think we know that bombs will not bring liberation, and Iranians are the only ones who can free themselves. And I don't say that as a slogan. I'm saying that based on historical analysis of what's happened in the past in Iran, on the fact that even from a purely military perspective, there's no scenario in which this kind of bombing campaign from above really like leads to a democratic transition. It's very hard to imagine how that happens, particularly given the reality on the ground in Iran. And as a result, I think it's as you mentioned, Trump does it less, but it's this cynical misuse, this cynical attempt to appropriate the Iranian struggle for freedom on the ground that has actually captured support among members of the Iranian diaspora. It has even convinced people in Iran that it's possible. But we've seen it across the region. We've seen it in the last few years in Gaza and Lebanon. We saw it in Iraq and Afghanistan. The United States took out the Taliban and then handed the country back over to the Taliban. And I think it's important for us to look at these historical examples, to look at the recent past, to look at Iran's longer past, and to recognize that bombs won't bring liberation to Iran.
Just a final question I wanted to put to you is about the diaspora, because we mentioned that before and I meant to ask you about it. I mean, there is obviously a very vocal, certainly very vocal element who've been supporting the war. And I guess in those situations, there are people who oppose the war, but then, you know, they will hear those voices and feel that they're talking over Iranians, including people who've suffered under the regime, for example. So I'm just wondering about just your thoughts about the dynamics within diaspora. That's obviously, again, it's not homogenous. Yeah. But you know, just about the politics of it. And obviously, because I know as well that those who have opposed of Iranian heritage who opposed the war have often come under quite vicious attack.
Yes.
So I'm just wondered, just your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think It's a tough question. I think it's important to remember that no one person can speak on behalf of a nation in the same way that if you interview a random American, that person doesn't represent all of the possible political views in that country. And I think there's been this idea that also people on the right have taken advantage of and really co-opted, that you have to listen to Iranian voices. I'm Iranian, I have a right to speak. Of course, Iranians have a right to speak, but at this moment, the US and Israel are carrying out this war. This is a global issue. And the fact that there are Iranians who support this, I don't think should be seen as evidence that we should not be opposing it, right? I'm an Iranian American. I oppose this war. I oppose Trump. I oppose the Iranian government's repression of free speech and democracy. I believe in a free Iran. And I oppose this war specifically because I do believe in a free Iran. And in the same way that in 2003, there were some Iraqis who cheered on the bombs and the global left stood and said, we know that these bombs won't bring liberation. We don't trust America to free Iraq. It's not going to happen. I think we need to keep that perspective in mind right now, right? We need to make alliances with people who share values, who share principles. We need to convince, we need to help convince members of the Iranian diaspora that this, that Trump is not going to bring liberation. He's very clear about it. And we need to understand that some of this is coming from a trauma response, people who have felt super repressed because the Iranian government is extremely repressive, but this doesn't mean that the political solution they propose is in fact like what's going to work, right?
Alex, honestly, really fascinating, really incisive stuff. I've learned a huge amount listening to you, and I know everyone who's been listening to this will have very much done the same. So I want to thank on behalf of everyone who's watched this for that really brilliant and thoughtful and nuanced exposition. So for those watching, please like, subscribe, leave your thoughts, leave your comments, always read those, share the video. But Alex, honestly, real honor to talk to you.
Thank you so much for having me.